Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And Nick, we are recording this on Monday morning because I might have tailgated a little too hard on Sunday. I understand how important St. Patrick's Day is to the Osello family, so I want you to know that I was honoring it appropriately. Basically, one day during the spring each year, my wife and her friends all have this big party around the Baltimore St. Patrick's Day Parade. So every year, I'm like checking my phone for scores as this game is going, or as the games are going on, while I'm out at the parade. And Sunday was no different. But wow, what a weekend once again of lacrosse action we've got to get to.
An incredible weekend, and quick little history lesson. So I always thought that the hostility that my dad and family showed towards St. Paddy's Day, because they're like, what are we doing celebrating the Irish? Why would we celebrate the Irish? History lesson in Butte, there was only one little Italian section of Butte, Montana, where my grandfather and father's side of the family is from. It was called Meaderville. So anytime you go to Butte and you're like, could I get the Meaderville sandwich? It's like the most stereotypical Italian poorly executed sandwich of all time. And there was legitimate hostility because I was like, Dad, what's the deal with, you know, Irish? And he's like, well, there were like two Italian kids, 500 Irish kids. So we just have to fight the Irish kids like all the time. There were like three fights every week. And it was always me or insert stereotypical Italian name. And we
Dino.
Had to fight. Yeah. Yeah. My brother Dino, my brother Guy. And because we were named Osello and Dino and Guy, we would have to fight the Connollys. We would have to fight the O'Malleys. So he literally grew up fighting the Irish people. And I was like,
the solution was right there. Just put an apostrophe between the first and second letter of your last name and you're all set.
Connor Kelly's dad, our goalie for high school, always did that to my dad and it drove him nuts. And I'm like, how are you getting bothered by O apostrophe Cello? And he's like, I don't know why it bothers me. And I'm like, you don't even have an accent. What? Why am I doing that? So how was it, though? Dog wedding? St. Paddy's Day. You got to choose one.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, St. Paddy's Day for the tradition, dog wedding for the novelty. It's potato, potato. So yeah, it was good, but it was also difficult not to be able to get eyes on a combination of Harvard, Michigan, Princeton, Rutgers, and Yale, Denver in real time. Fortunately, been able to catch up over the course of the last 12 to 16 hours. But let's dive in, buddy.
Good. Very glad. And Terry did tailgate too hard. Also, we had a scheduled time, and I was jet lagged from San Diego. I took a nap and set my phone for 6:15 because we were going to start recording at 6:30 p.m. Mountain. Put 6:30 a.m. and literally incepted myself. And again, I know we got to jump in, but it was such a detailed dream that it was literally inception because I walked into this room in my dream, sat down here, and then I was like, I usually don't have this much spitter. Like, I don't chew tobacco, but I was like, this is a weird amount of spitters on my desk. I got to clean this up. We hopped on and Coach Byrne joined. And Coach Byrne joined in front of the Golden Dome. And I'm like, that's weird. He's at Harvard. But we got to rip this podcast. And then it snapped in my head that I was like, I don't chew tobacco and Coach Byrne's at Harvard. And like the whole dream came crumbling down and I went like, and I woke up like 15 minutes late and you were already like, let's scrap it. So it was an awesome, it was like the details. Okay. So what a weekend. You called it. And my goodness, is the number one spot cursed. So we're going to start with Yale Denver. And I'm just going to say, I don't think the number one spot lasts consistently ever this year. I think this is an awesome year where there's conference parity, there's team parity, number one's not safe, anybody can beat anybody. And what was, I thought, most interesting about this game is Yale was pretty much had like a semi-decimated roster, certainly throughout the week. They were battling affluenza all week long. And influenza. Boom. Gotcha, Yale. But I mean, they had terminal tummy aches, and their practice roster was, 50% capacity?
Yeah, they were like at like 20 to 25 guys all week.
Which is crazy to me, like to not have that preparation, and especially going into a game plan against a team like Denver, which is going to show you new looks. This is a huge
playing at altitude
for Yale. Playing at altitude, like the amount of resilience that Yale showed goes well beyond just this final score, which was impressive nonetheless. Got to start with Brandao, who had 2 goals and 3 assists, and this was we've talked about how no lead is safe. There wasn't even really great runs. It was tied at 8 separate times throughout the third quarter, back and forth, no team really being able to break away until Yale finally went up 13-10. They ended up winning the faceoff battle. The insight that I got from this game from TD Ireland said, the refs are terrible both ways. Thanks, TD. Everybody loves a guy that complains about ref. And just a great
Sunday
game. Well,
you
Sunday
know how
game.
Unbiased he is because he played for both of these teams.
He played for both of those teams. So I was like, yeah, but like, what are you actually seeing? And he's like, oh, the refs are bad. And I'm like, wow, hard-hitting analysis. I'm never calling you while we're on this podcast again. But Terry, number one goes down, and Yale with a statement victory given the underlying sickness that this team was facing.
Yeah, so I think it's hard to decide which is the team to attack this from first. I think when you look at it from Denver's point of view, the simple fact is they've had a little bit of a miracle season so far. And, you know, it would be, you know, to an extent beating a dead horse with respect to how unlikely their comeback was against Hopkins and how if that game goes the other way, they're not number one, right? And, you know, if they come up with the home win against Cornell that they did, they are a, you know, good Pioneer team that has had, you know, some good performances and some bad performances, but they aren't thought of in the way that they were heading into this. But that's also discrediting how good they actually are. And what's interesting is when you try to dive into the combination of why they are as good as they are, it for me comes back to there isn't a significant area of weakness anywhere on the field. And that is counteracted by the fact that, you know, they might not necessarily have a super high ceiling offensively because they don't have that number one Dodger who's going to run past guys consistently and draw slides. And defensively, because, you know, I don't think that they have goaltending that can get to 60-65%, you know, once every 3 or 5 games. But they, you know, they're incredibly efficient defensively. They're incredibly efficient offensively, and they tend to win the possession battle because they face off well and they clear well. Well, in this case, that wasn't the case. It's specifically at the faceoff X, and Machado Rodriguez, who has had a really good season, but you know hasn't garnered like kind of super high end attention based on either his statistics or the particular performances. Partly because of the competition that he's gone against so far, and the fact that Yale's only played, you know, this was their 4th game. It's not as if, you know, they played a ton of games so far relative to most other teams who are in, you know, 6 or 7 games into their schedule. But Rodriguez has been really good, and, you know, he was over 50% against Al Stathakis, who was the guest of the D-Fly and Dixie podcast last week, which, you know, they had touted the podcast bump that they had been providing, and unfortunately that came to a screeching halt.
Oops.
But with all that being said, Yale was, I mean, they're just an excellent offense, right? They have been a top 3 to 5 offense over the course of the last several years, and this was no different. And the thing that is most impressive is that they're doing this without Leo Johnson and Chris Lyons, but that's been the case all season, so, you know, at some point we kind of just have to move on. And they are very different without those two guys, particularly from the standpoint of the dodging burden, right? And what you get with David Anderson, who is inserted into that starting attack group, is a catch-and-shoot finisher on the inside that is just not a presence that they had. And I think a lot of folks maybe conceive of Lyons that way because he is predominantly a goal scorer. But he's a righty-wing shooter who's an incredible dodger, both from X, from kind of the low righty corner and then from the righty wing. And that's not Anderson's game. So you just transition from the kind of relatively evenly distributed usage of possessions for Yale offensively into a much more kind of brand out oriented, number one attackman oriented offense that is supported by a combination of Carson Kuhl, who Andy Shea in his postgame comments said that he didn't think he had his best game, and then just a wave after wave of midfielders who are able to handle a lot of that top-down dodging responsibility and counterbalance what Yale's offense brings from a behind-the-cage X type of component. So point being that the other part of analyzing this game, I think, starts from who was Yale against Penn State a week ago? Were they the team that got out to the 9-2 halftime lead, or were they the team that let that lead slip largely in the early part or mid part of the third quarter and then still managed to kind of hold on to a two-goal lead throughout the second half and made it seem like they were going to win and then had the ball and took four shots in overtime and still couldn't win the game, right? So the way we think about the Bulldogs is very different depending on the outcome of that game. Right, especially because, you know, I mentioned that that was their third game. Their second game was against Colgate at Albany, a neutral site venue. The game was not streamed. So even though this is a team that won the 2018 National Championship, won or made it to the 2019 National Championship game, is one of the kind of premier programs in college lacrosse, they still are a tremendous blind spot a month into the season relative to, again, most of the other teams in Division I. So now they have a showcase game, you know, 2 o'clock Eastern time on a Sunday. It's the, you know, only game of that level that's going on. And they're behind a paywall that is specific to Denver, right? So even now, not a lot of people are watching it. So they are, you know, squared up against their premier chief rival next Saturday in a game that we're going to talk a little bit about. We don't do a ton of previewing on this show, but it's just too impossible to resist when you consider that the Ivy League, which had basically the same conference schedule for like 50 years in a row, reshuffled the deck. And so Harvard-Yale, which was traditionally the last game of the regular season, is now going to kick off the Ivy League slate for both of these teams. Harvard coming in undefeated, Yale coming in 3-1 with only a second half collapse separating them from being undefeated themselves, and coming off of a win over the number one team in the country. It is very, very juicy. I haven't made the decision on whether or not I'm going to get to New Haven yet, but I have put in some serious consideration for it.
And maybe that's a theme. You kind of started off with like, which team do we kind of start by analyzing? And to me, like, not only looking at the scoreboards, looking at the results, you know, kind of taking a bit of a deeper dive, it's like, do we want to, like, say that Team A lost it or that Team B won it? That's, like, a stupid trope that I've kind of always hated. But I think it's particularly applicable for this weekend. And when I start thinking about, like, teams in general, my mind immediately goes back to scouting reports. And I would say that as it relates to, if we were preparing for Denver, for example, I talk a lot about these Denver like scouting reports, quote unquote. There's frustration as a player, but there's opportunity as a player going into that game. The frustration is there's not really one area in particular to exploit, but every single one of those areas that we can't exploit could also come back to beat us. You have to play a very balanced game. It starts at the faceoff. You're going to have to just play solid across the board. So I think that like a win over Denver, which, you know, again, outside of the Hopkins kind of anomaly, I think that to beat a team like Denver, you just have to play good consistently across the board. And a win over Denver represents a little bit more balance in your team, a little bit of a, okay, we can put together a game plan for faceoffs, for offense, for defense, for clearing, for writing, and execute it at a pretty high level. And again, the part that fascinates me is they didn't really have a lot of time over the course of the week to dial in these game plans. So the additions on offense, as well as their discipline, and, you know, I don't know how sick they were or what Shea was doing to prepare them, but I gotta say, this is one of the best victories of the year, given those circumstances and given their opponent. I think that it gives them and it makes that Harvard matchup one of the most interesting matchups in the first half of the season. And then conversely for Denver, I really want to get Silstrop back on or one of the DU players, because anytime we got ranked number one, we just dreaded going into practice. I think I've talked about it on the podcast before, but you get ranked number one and Coach Corrigan comes into practice the very first Monday morning practice after those polls come out and he goes, "You guys think you're so good? You guys think you're hot shit? Well, guess what? We're not that good. We need to focus." And would wear us out so hard over practice because we were reading the tabloids that nobody cared about on the team. So I'm curious if kind of Brown's first year, he gets ranked number one and he's like, "You guys think you're good? Well, we still got work to do." He kind of wore DU out over the course of the week, saying, "Don't get cocky." Yale kind of was sick. I can't wait to kind of break it down and see how both teams bounce back. So Yale DU, sneaky, great game.
No doubt. But the bounce back potential for the Pioneers is a stiff one because they head to Ohio State on St. Patrick's Day. Then they head to Durham to take on Duke in 2 weeks. And then they open Big East play at Villanova on March 30th. They do not play at home again until April 5th. So, you know, for a team that when they travel, it's more onerous, let's say, than a lot of other teams. It's a stiff test coming up over the course of the next week.
It's not too hard to travel from Denver. They have the elevation advantage, and they can outrun and run and gun with teams. Anything else on Yale-Denver before moving on? And is the number one spot cursed? Is the number one spot cursed this year?
Well, so Army just took over the number one spot in the Inside Lacrosse media poll, and I don't know. I mean, they've got Lehigh, then BU, then North Carolina. So now that's all kind of, that's not necessarily between now and next week, right? In terms of, are they going to be able to hold on to the number one spot for more than a week? But yeah, it's, I don't think it's cursed so much as the timing of the decisions has corresponded with when teams have very stiff tests upcoming. And, you know, I'm stammering because Lehigh looked pretty good this past weekend. So they graduated a ton of talent, new coach, but at the same time, they early reports of Lehigh's demise might be greatly exaggerated, and so as a result, they're going to give the Black Knights everything they can handle for sure.
Got it. The next game, and this is an undefeated team that I would say has flown considerably under the radar, Harvard. And the reason I would say they've flown under the radar is if we look at their first five wins, Providence, Bryant, Bucknell, Merrimack, Vermont, with one goal wins over Bryant and Bucknell and a three goal win over Vermont. So while they are undefeated, I wouldn't say that they had kind of like this statement victory. They haven't really been on the map because of those close games. And it would be easy to create a narrative in which you just attribute that 5-0 start to their schedule. And I think a lot of people expected Michigan either to be their first loss or to kind of see if they can rise to the challenge. Well, what did they do? They absolutely rose to the challenge, went into Ann Arbor and won 13-11. And I think this is the one that kind of puts Harvard on the map and they go, okay, yeah, Harvard's been undefeated, but now they've beat Michigan. Shocker, Jerry Burns' defense is good and held Michigan to two goals in the first half. They went up 4-0, then it was 7-2, 10-3. So this was kind of Harvard jumping out and dominating from the start. The Wolverines clawed their way back. It was 12-9, but really I don't think there was ever that we really got to dial it in. We really have to be careful here with the two-goal, three-goal buffer right up until the very end. Sam King for Harvard is an absolute stud. I watched their game against Merrimack because my girlfriend's brother plays there, that tough game for Merrimack. But what impressed me was kind of like not only Sam King on Harvard, but a lot of their offensive distribution. They have weapons all over the place. And in addition to Jerry Burns' defense, which only improves year after year, I think this gives Harvard a little bit of momentum, just like we were talking about with Yale going into next week's matchup. Freshman Jackson Green, who's been not silent, but he kind of had a bit of a breakout game, having his first two-goal game of the season, throwing an assist in. But 10 offensive players scored for Harvard. So it was cool to see that, yeah, they have weapons all over the field, but even if Sam King, who had two goals and two assists, is cut off, They're a well-balanced, well-distributed, credit to Neil Hutchinson, fun offense to watch. Logan Ipp's dynamic, Sam King, you got freshmen. For Michigan, Christian Ronda had 4-1, but Havid played wicked good, Terry.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. First of all, incredible breakdown by you. Wow. When I was watching this game in real time and saw Michigan jump out to that lead, I couldn't help but think about the fact. I couldn't help but think about the fact that Harvard led 9-3 last year and Michigan came back and won that game 19-13. And it was kind of the launching pad, I think, in some respects. Obviously, the win over Maryland was viewed as being kind of the actual like verification, so to speak, of what Michigan could be and turned into as the season went on. Even then, you know, that Maryland game in, I believe, late March, early April, ended up giving way to a loss at Rutgers in the regular season. So I guess my point is that, you know, that game, particularly because, you know, this is now a couple years in a row that it's not as if it was only a two-game series, right? They played 3 years ago as well. And if memory serves, this, you know, Michigan started, I believe, 7-0 in 22. And then their loss to Harvard gave way to an eight-game losing streak, and they ended up finishing the season 7-8. And so as a result, my point is that, you know, this is a series that has meant a lot to these two teams. And I think you're right, you know, to frame it around verification of who Harvard either is or might be as this season goes along. And I think that the reaction to, you know, this Harvard team through the first part of the season was exactly how good they were offensively. And I think that if there is a theme to the first, you know, 20 minutes of this conversation, it is that the best offenses right now are very multiple, very diverse, hard to prepare for because of the variety of weapons that you have to game plan for. It's exactly what you were just talking about. And Harvard is no different. To the extent that they might be, it is because of where you started your analysis of Harvard, which is Sam King. And what's interesting is, you know, I don't think in my kind of conception of offense and players and all that sort of stuff, Sam King is not a traditional quarterback because he is pretty small and really fast and left-handed. And it's just not, that's not the makeup of like your typical like offense trigger guy. But at the same time, he is such a good distributor and he is a really unselfish player in a lot of ways that it's very clear to me at least that he's just a perfect kind of catalyst for this group. And what's different, I think, from last year to this year is, you know, and it's kind of funny. The NBA always refers to itself as a make or miss league. And I think that that can be a little bit reductive and you don't want to be that reductive when it comes to analysis. But you look at, you know, team over year performance from certain teams. And like, for instance, Syracuse, right? Finn Thompson has not shot nearly as well as he did last season. There's, you know, a lot of variables that go into that. And sometimes the difference between a great offense and a good offense or a good offense and a mediocre offense is one guy, you know, shooting 22% when traditionally he shoots 35%. And so when I look at this Harvard group, it is important to note what you did, which is a lot of the, not Jackson Green is the only freshman contributor or whatever. It's not just about the overall offensive contributors, but it is also about the role that having seven guys, eight guys that are going to come in on your top two midfield lines and your other two attackmen and then have unique scouts for them because they each know their role, they know how to execute it, and the defense has to be prepared for how those guys are going to execute the role. It's a tough task. It's a tough challenge, and I think that's why, you know, Harvard, for our numbers right now, are the number three team in number three offense in college lacrosse.
Yeah, well, and combine that with, and if anybody complains about dogs barking on this podcast, we'll slap you upside the head. Dogs are one of the best reasons. Credit to humanity for all of the animals out there to domesticate. We chose dogs and horses. Great job. Credit to us. But especially like even watching that Merrimack game, it's interesting to watch games with my girlfriend because she just thinks that Merrimack is playing bad. But as it relates to your point right there, the thing that would have the thing that impressed me most that I was watching where I'm like, well, how do you stop this? is the unique ways in which Harvard can initiate, score, and get great looks from long approaches after like dodge, ball movement. You kind of slough into the defense, and then you approach out on the new initiator. And a good amount of their players can beat you both ways. They're initiating from spots on the field, which they can go both ways and be dangerous in both ways. I feel like a lot of times when you watch even a college offense and even high-level Division I offense, you're like, oh, great, here we go. Here comes your classic dodge down the alley. And what Harvard does such a great job of is their dodges are going anywhere. Their skip passes are going to the back pipe, to the near pipe, to the crease, forward for a step down. And they had a great game man up on that game as well. And I think that's also a testament to just their ability to distribute the ball. And again, kind of piggybacking off another of your point, to have so many initiators, so many guys who are attacking that late approach, to have so many offensive players, but none of them really playing selfish or kind of like overdoing it in their role. I was like, okay, anytime you start talking about a Jerry Byrne based team, it starts with defense, but I wasn't blown away by their defense. I was blown away by their offense, which makes Harvard sneaky, scary, and gives me a lot of weight. Like, I'm going to put a lot of weight into that Harvard-Yale game as what I think is going to happen for the rest of the season for each team.
100%. And I also think that, you know, to the point that you made about Harvard's defense, and I've only been able to watch highlights of this game. So, I am interested in going back and watching the film, because you don't get a lot of what I'm about to talk about just through highlights. But, you know, and hopefully we have an opportunity to ask him this question here in a second. What I am interested in, and you know, this is kind of a legacy of his approach to coaching defense, and you played for it, so you know this a lot better than I do, but basically, like, how matchup conscious you are over the course of the week in terms of preparation, right? And your willingness the kind of tendency to switch and be open to switching picks and not being overly conscious about what a particular offensive player might do. And what's interesting about Michigan is that there are some similarities in terms of the hierarchy of their personnel to Harvard, insofar as, you know, Michael Boehm is so important to them, and he has a lot of the same attributes that Sam King does. And so I can imagine a scenario in which Harvard's defensive personnel was a little bit more prepared to guard Mike Boehm, because the player that they guard in practice every day has a lot of those similar physical attributes. So like I said, hopefully we had an opportunity to ask him, and now we do. Jerry Byrne, thanks for joining the Tailgate Podcast. How's it going, brother?
What's up? How you guys doing?
Hey, Coach.
Doing great.
What's up, Nick? You've been doing some neck rolls? You're looking a little thick up there.
I've gotten back into the gym, and they're like, you know, people will ask me, what am I doing in the gym? I know a couple things, and I'm getting back into the hang clean, into front squat game, and people are like, you're 30 and fat and bald. Why are you doing that? And I go, well, because I don't know anything else. So, and you're looking great too, Coach.
Thank you, man. I'm trying to be as far away from the cell phone as possible.
Got it. Well, Terry, go ahead and kick it off with the question.
Well, so I think we'll start there. How do you describe that Michigan game in terms of the way that it unfolded? What were the important factors in the outcome? And then, you know, I'll follow up with where I was leading prior to your joining.
I think there, as someone once said, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. But one of the things that's kind of a certainty is you got to get saves at critical moments, and you got to win some faceoffs at critical moments. We got some saves in the first half and didn't do great on the in the faceoff game, and then it kind of flipped in the second half. But I think in general we were really efficient on offense. You know, Neil Hutchinson, who is our offense coordinator, and we've been together for 5 years now, just did an unbelievable job of kind of being really democratic offensively. And then defensively, Nick Grill, he and I kind of partner on defense, brought a lot of kind of his knowledge from, you know, playing at Marquette in Maryland and in the PLL and kind of helping me with picks because Michigan is a really aggressive picking team, like militant about it. And I felt like we were really prepared there. So I think we consistently got them down to the last 15 seconds of a possession, which, you know, when Nick was playing, that was like, you know, we got him in the shot clock and no one wants to shoot. Now that's the scariest part of a possession, you know, desperate and guys willing to go all in. So it's really kind of the scariest part of a defensive possession. But I felt like we did really well there. And Barney, Andrew Barnard, Christian Barnard, Andrew was his dad, sorry. Christian had some great saves.
So one of the things that we were talking about prior to your joining was, you know, for 15 years, you and I have spoken about how matchup conscious your defenses are, or probably better said, are not. But that has a different manifestation depending on how particularly oriented around one or two players an offense is, and particularly relative to how unique their athletic attributes are. And the point I was making is I wondered whether or not your defensive personnel was a little bit better prepared to take on Michigan because Mike Boeheim and Sam King have a fair amount of similarities in terms of their athletic attributes. How did you, and how do you, I guess, is your philosophy still as kind of, this might be a really dumb question, right? But are you still as kind of, do you feel similarly about, you know, not caring about matchups, being, you know, comfortable switching, especially in terms of what you talked about with Michigan's militant nature to the pick game? And then how did you approach number five for the Wolverines?
I still don't, like, tell people who to guard. We don't have it on the scouting report that, you know, Joe Schmo is guarding Jim Jones. You know, that when guys walk out there, I can't remember the last time I said something about someone, you want to guard him at the, you know, because we're playing kind of a fluid help support defense. So, you know, we don't go with ones against ones as much, but just because of the way our season has unfolded. We played, I don't know, 6 games in 20 days. So you didn't have as much time to do that kind of work where you might get ones against ones. But we have enough really good lefties on our team that can give us kind of the jabby hop, you know, split roll hesitation game that Boeheim plays. So, you know, but I don't, you know, we talk about who their, you know, their better players are, but every team to win really good games, your 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th scorer has to make plays, either hockey assist or actual goals. And I think that was a contrasting story of this game. And we had, I don't know, 9, 10, or 11 people who had points. And I think that was more than our opponent had. So, you know, you can get the look of a guy in a variety of ways. And, you know, Nick knows some of the things that we did in my previous life. And so, you know, but it's less about it. We got to stop this guy. You know, I know some people approach the game that way, and it can work for you. But I think more holistically, I think, you know, Coach Grill has done a good job of helping kind of me develop my understanding of how to play picks. So, you know, we try to play picks better and not work, you know, and still, you know, be aware of whether we're switching or getting through. But, you know, if a switch happens, it happens. I got 99 problems, but a switch ain't one.
I'm so curious about that because I had this big moment of realization when I started playing professionally, which is about 99% matchup oriented. You even prepare for picks differently, which was difficult for me to make the adjustment to because I'm like, I don't care who we're playing. I'm playing burn method defense. So when you say that he helps you play picks differently, the moment of realization that I had was I was applying my mindset 3 or 4 years out of college retroactively to me, who was struggling to understand even the basics of defense, especially as a freshman sophomore. When you say that he's helping you play picks a little bit differently or better, what have those adjustments been?
You know, I think, you know, you look at the way Maryland historically has played picks, which I think, you know, comes from a little basketball mindset, whether you're just stacking, like getting kind of a guy behind a guy. If you're stacking and whacking, kind of that's what I call it, kind of your one-handed fake splash, where evidently you can just hit a guy as hard as you want now. And it's not a splash, but that's a conversation for a different time or whether you kind of chase and kind of try to deter the guy. You chased after him and then chased back to force him kind of wide around a pick, you know. So, we had never done that, you know. And so learning how to do that, and Ted Bergman, who was my old defensive assistant, you know, we had started instituting that last year, and Nick helped us take it to a whole other level. And so it means you switch less, which means it makes it harder for them to get the matchups that they want, because Michigan is a very good team, very well coached, and they worked really hard for Cohen and Bain to get the ball. And if you can delay that and defer it with some good riding and some sub-game stuff, which they like to do, next thing you know, they're down to a 30-second functional possession. And now if you're playing picks better, it takes them longer to get their matchup. Now you have the potential to be down to 15 or 20 seconds. And, you know, I think we're a pretty good defensive team. I think we can play defense for 15 to 20 seconds. So I think all of that kind of the math of that can help you. But it's mostly around, are we stacking? Are we stacking and whacking? Are we chipping? Are we switching? Are we jump switching and double teaming? So I think we kind of showcase the variety of those things that we can do.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating to hear you talk about picks, because I just remember, hey, guard your man as good as you can, work harder than the other guy off ball. Credit to Nick.
Yeah, I think that worked much better in the pre-shot clock era. And, you know, if you're not evolving, you're dying. So, I mean, old guy trying to learn new tricks.
That was going to be my other comment, is boy, do I wish we had that against those horrific DU games where they did the possession shots and had 7-minute possessions. But we're not going to unpack that here. Another question from me. So as we looked, and we were just talking about this, wins are not hard to come by at any point in the season. So you come into this game undefeated, and that could be arguably a function of schedule, a function of execution. Did this game, and I expect a bit of a coach speak answer, we don't care who we're playing, we're coming away with the victory, but did this game kind of solidify, like, hey, we're undefeated and we have a marquee win under our belt, you better watch out for the Crimson this year? Or was this just business as usual?
Yeah, present company excluded. I think, you know, often the media just has a narrative that the easiest explanation is probably the one that we can go with. Like perception and how people see you, you know, you can't, it affects you, because we're all human. Anybody who says, oh, we don't look at the polls, or we don't look at what people are saying, are lying. You know, it's hard to avoid it. It's hard to, because, you know, whether it's, and I talked to the team about the text I'm getting from, you know, both people who are supportive and people like, you guys haven't played anybody and we'll see what you're made of. Like, you get it from all areas. And so if you accept the fact that you can't ignore it, then you just, you know, you're not doing anything for them. You know, so, you know, we played the schedule that we played. You don't always control how well maybe some of the teams on your schedule have evolved in their own things. And we've played some really good teams that pushed us to the limit, and I expect those teams to have really good years. But the flip of that argument is also true, meaning that legacy type programs, now not name, but it's reality, is that a loss to a defeat of that team means a lot. A loss to that team doesn't hurt you as much. A team that doesn't maybe have a long legacy of success, but has been good in the past, you get some bump. If you haven't had consistent success and you beat one of those teams, you get a little bump up. So it's all part of the ecosystem of this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, the coach speak answer is, you know, this is who we're playing. I mean, we want to win, just like we want to win next weekend as well.
Yeah, Terry, how about you stop with the bias of successful programs? I'm sick of it. Yeah, good call, Coach Burns.
I said present company excluded.
So you pointed to we could talk all day, but we got to be respectful for your time. And you pointed to next weekend, and it's really interesting because the Ivy League, after not doing so for like 60 years, reordered the schedule of regular season games. And now, as opposed to ending your regular season with Harvard's rival, Yale, you're opening Ivy League play with Harvard's rival, Yale. The Bulldogs are coming off of a win over Denver in Denver, and so they've got to get back home, and then you'll square up in New Haven on Saturday. It's Monday. We don't do a ton of previewing, but have you gotten an opportunity to get eyes on the Bulldogs yet, and what are your thoughts on a combination of this schedule realignment that now sees you open Ivy League play against your rival, and what it means for your team, especially given that you're coming off of a Sunday game, a win that we just talked about the merits of internally, and I would imagine that you're going to have to you get kind of a benefit and a detriment, right? Like, you have to worry about them being a little high on their horse, but at the same time, you know you're going to get a focused group when you get back on the practice field.
Yeah, no, there's a lot in there. The us playing Yale first, I mean, I think Andy and I would have preferred it to be the last game, but, you know, sometimes democracy works, and, you know, votes count, people. So, you know, they voted, and the coaches wanted, you know, to reorganize that. And so that's what happens. And so whatever, I don't like, you know, one man, one vote. And so, that's why that's happening. The second part of have not looked at them at all. We haven't played. I'm trying to remember if we played a common opponent yet, but I haven't watched them yet. We'll start later in the week on them. You know, this is only the second week since we started back in early February where we don't have three games in 7 days. So we get to focus on ourselves for a couple of days. You know, we're on spring break, so we're doing a bunch of team building and social stuff with our guys besides the lifting and film and practice. And, you know, listen, I think this is, you know, if not the longest, one of the longest sports rivalries in college. So, you know, I think they'll be, you know, with you know, both schools having huge alumni in New York City and the Westchester area. It's going to be a, you know, 2 years ago was an overtime game in my first full season, and that was a pretty epic game that didn't end our way, but I think it made a statement of, you know, after not having some competitive games in prior years, you know, we had the lead with 90 seconds and didn't close it out. So I don't there's not a doubt in our team that we can, you know, compete with them, and I think we've proven that for the last couple of years. So I think it's going to be, you know, one of the great games in college lacrosse this year.
Quick one for me. I was actually just reading an article earlier this week about the history of the pranks that the Harvard student body and the Yale student body would pull on each other during football games. Are you leveraging the student body, maybe the alumni base, to pull a quick one, a fast one, whether it's in the stands, you know, anything like
that? In the financial markets, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe we short a stock, perhaps.
You know, I was thinking maybe you do the naked mile, Nick, and just like if it's not going well in any moment, just kind of run onto the field. No one will recognize you.
We're going streaking. We're going up through the gymnasium and back through the quad. And really, final one for me, and this one really has nothing to do with college lacrosse, but I'm trying to work with a high school program here that I'm trying to implement the burn method, talking about picks, talking about on-ball defense. I went and watched their first game, and they opened up in zone. What should I say to that head coach?
You're the assistant coach?
No, I'm just with broadcasting. I'm not here consistently enough. I'm just kind of like a gun for hire.
So you're a special consultant.
The special consultant. We're doing 34 lunch pail, double crease drill, and they come out and open in zone.
You know, I think one of the great things about being a consultant is you don't want to get too emotionally attached to your ideas. You know what I mean? Or if you're angling, you know, for his job. No, listen, I think one of the things that coaches at a lot of levels do is talk too much, and they don't, like, you remember our practices and not a lot of meetings and talking. Like, you gotta, practice is for doing, film is for analysis, you know, meetings are for development. And so, you know, as you walk up from the parking lot, when you show up as special consultant, if 75% of the team is standing around, you know, tell them we should start playing or doing stuff that involves kind of moving and
not
coaching
a 45-minute speech about my accolades.
Did you say 4.5 minutes?
45 minutes.
Oh, okay. My bad. I thought you said 4.5.
No
worries. 4.5 minutes. Good.
Jerry Byrne, we really appreciate your time on the Tailgate Podcast. Congrats on the win over Michigan. We look forward to watching you. What? You wanted
no,
more?
I'm saying no comment on my screen name, Jules Monroe.
Yeah, I loved it. I was saving it for after you were gone.
All right. Yeah. All right.
Do you have any views on the Oscars?
What's that?
What did you think of John Cena?
We were on a plane. We kept flying home. I didn't get home until whatever 10:30 after we got back home here. So I didn't. What did he do?
Steve O'Sullivan's son. You want to explain?
He came out. I don't know, naked, holding the card over his private parts. It was very weird.
Was it an 8x10 or a 3x5?
It was right in the middle, and I think the stage might have been a little cold. So,
okay. Well, I think that could be some inspiration for you in New Haven next weekend. There,
okay. I love it.
Perfect. I'll be running all out right there with the card. You just give me the signal, and I'm out there.
Jules Monroe, thank you for joining us on the Tailgate
Coach
Podcast.
You're welcome. See you guys. Bye bye.
Huge shout out to Coach Byrne. That's a guy I take a bullet for. The best coach that I've ever had. And credit to him for not making any comments about zone defense played in Boise, Idaho. The next game, Syracuse Hopkins, the battle of the insufferable fan bases. So the number two team took a number two and lost to Syracuse. Very proud that I came up with that one. Enough about anyone on Syracuse other than Michael Leo, who literally had one goal, but I just love watching him play. So he wasn't.
He plays with so much energy.
Oh my God, he's so much fun. So anytime Leo has the goal on Syracuse or has the ball on Syracuse, I just expect something crazy to happen. So it was 14-13. Syracuse comes away with a one goal game. Tough to start with anywhere other than faceoffs and clearing. And those two kind of go hand in hand with the possession game, but are both very different in their execution and how teams prep and game plan for it and everything like that. So Syracuse went 22 for 31 on faceoffs, and Hopkins went 11 for 17 on clearing. Not great, Bob. That makes it an uphill battle the entire game. So what I also want to talk about, the most overused phrase I would say in all of sports is silenced the haters. I hate it. I never like it. This is the only game I would expect all year in which it could be applicable. I almost just had a stroke saying that word. My goodness. But Joey Spallina has been accused of only, you know, padding his stats when they play lesser opponents and then being silent in big games. But he arrived on the scene, 2 goals, 4 assists. Hiltz had 2 goals and 3 assists. And Syracuse had a 3-goal run in the third and a 4-goal run in the fourth, but Hopkins always seemed to answer. This was kind of that classic, what we've talked about seeing this season. One team strikes, the other team strikes back. For Hopkins, Degnan had 5 and Jealous had 3. But writing and faceoffs are the worst parts of all practices. And I would expect Hopkins preparation week this week to be not very fun. Syracuse Hopkins, what do you got?
You nailed it there at the end. So there are a couple things. When we do our possession numbers, and Lax Reference is really kind of the only other large, you know, wide scale purveyor of possession based analytics. And we define possessions differently, specifically around whether a failed clear qualifies as possession. And you know, for us, it doesn't, right? An offensive possession would quantify as like a settled offensive possession after a clear is successful. And so on that basis, when I looked at the box score after, and it was crazy because I didn't necessarily feel this while I was watching the game, I can't remember a game with between two high-level teams that only featured a combined 21 successful clears, which was a reflection of the efficiency that each team scored with, right? The reason that there were so few successful clears is because so many possessions didn't end in a clear attempt. They ended in a face-off because there were 27 combined goals in this game. But then the other side of the coin was that there were a lot of failed clears. And for me, you know, you look at the matchups and it's hard if you're Hopkins and a Hopkins fan to say like, well, I say this, but even as I do, I'm thinking about Jerry Ragonese's tweets during the game and the lack of kind of a consistent set call when the faceoffs were getting set up. But my main point is Mason Cohn's really good, and so if these two teams were to play again, it's you know, hard to forecast how the faceoff matchup would go. Logan Callahan has been excellent. Tyler Dunn, as a change of pace option, hasn't been as good as he was last year, and I would expect he's going to have his moment as the season progresses. But it was the six failed clears that were, for me, kind of the death knell for Hopkins, because in addition to a game with so few successful clears, Hopkins scored on 60% of their possessions, which is insane. To score on 60% of your possessions, like, that's Notre Dame versus, you know, Cleveland State level efficiency, but to do it and lose is just even more insane. So if you're Hopkins, like, I don't know what you're talking about when you go to practice on Monday, other than we've got to clear the ball, fellas, because if we can clear the ball successfully, even if we're struggling to face off, we're still going to win this game. And, you know, the defensive performance, our guy from last week, Chase Erland, had another really nice game. And if Hopkins had won, you wouldn't have been able to say anything other than they won, not exclusively because of him, but he was the biggest reason that they won. And still, Syracuse was right around 40% offensively. And I think that that's just a reflection of, again, how good they are. And to your point about silence the haters, like, my issue with the haters' comments coming away from the Maryland and Army games were a combination of effectively, like, so Joey Spallina is the number one recruit, in my opinion, because of how high his floor is as a player. I've compared him to Shaq Stanwyck in that way. He is constantly on Instagram because he plays with a style that produces highlight-worthy clips. Those two things do not mean that members of the media or folks that analyze are saying he is a good enough player to run past number one defenseman consistently. And so when he's being guarded by AJ Pilot or Ajax Zapatello, yeah, like, he's not going to get his game is very dependent on his teammates' game, insofar as he's going to throw assist passes. They have to be open to catch and then finish those. And then separately, like, yeah, if he's going to get a screen in order to score off the dodge, like, there's no harm in that. We just spent like 15 minutes talking to Jerry Byrne, widely regarded as one of the best defensive minds in the game, about how playing screens is kind of the fundamental nature of defense. And so it stands to reason that playing screens is a huge part of it. And, you know, if you're going to applaud somebody for spending their summer playing box lacrosse in Canada, you have to expect that they're going to come back not just with extra handle or extra willingness to throw into tight windows or, you know, really good ground ball compete level. They're also going to come back with a really good understanding of how to set and use screens. And so all of this is to say that I watched the Syracuse Army and Syracuse Maryland games, and I came away more impressed with the games that Joey had than a lot of people did. Now, that being said, no question, from a box score production standpoint, it's not at the level of what he has done against the lesser teams on their schedule. But this game, 4-2, obviously is. And even still, like, you know, I didn't come away from that being like, oh, wow, like, Joey played so much better than he has at any other point over the course of the season. So I guess from the standpoint of moving forward, what it means for each team, there will be, you know, there's this notion that Syracuse really needed, or they needed it more. From a NCAA tournament resume standpoint, that is true. From a how good they either think or know they are, losing an overtime at home to a top five team means that you're right there as a top five team. So this just shows they're right there as a top five team. And if you're Hopkins, like, I don't think that they lost this game because they thought they were too good after beating Virginia or anything along those lines. I think they lost this game because they didn't get the ball enough. And whether that needs to be addressed to the faceoff X or in the clearing game, and obviously there's one element that you can control a little bit more than others in terms of a team-wide basis, preparation, practice standpoint, all that sort of stuff, you know, it's just kind of keep the train rolling forward. You got Navy next. Let's refocus on the midshipmen.
There are a couple points. I don't know. In my lifetime, I don't really know how to frame this up, but when I'm like, oh, this very stupid thing that I'm seeing is actually good for the sport. And I feel like we've had two instances of that this year. The first was the Pretty Boy Conference that sparked all of that. And I was like, good. Coaches kind of getting into the playpen and saying stuff that is riling people up on social media. Like that buzz is good. That immediately became a bit from, I would assume, all the way at the high school level. We're saying, you know, we're going to play Pretty Boy, insert your opponent for next week, all the way to, you know, PLL guys and, you know, the best of the best immediately making that a joke as well. I thought that was a very good thing. I also think it's a very good thing that people were talking about Joey Spallina, saying like, he's not showing up in big games. And to your point, he is still having a massive impact on those games. But as I look at why I think that's good, shows me that people might not be tuning into the game as much, or they're not understanding the game as much, but they're still interested in essentially getting on social media and talking shit about collegiate athletes. And I'm like, well, that's also very stupid. And there are a lot of 40-year-olds going, what are we doing here? That's part of the game.
It's better than it not happening.
It's better than just radio silence about any performance across the board. Syracuse and Hopkins, fascinating. All their losses are one-goal losses to top, depending on how the rankings come out, potentially just the top four teams, three, four, five. So credit to Syracuse. I would say in the insufferable fan base, I would give Hopkins the number one. So thank you that we didn't have to see the Hopkins alumnus and fan base taunt that they are the best. So in the blowout that really surprised me, moving on, Penn State, 7 billion, Cornell, 9. So final score was actually 20-9. And it's tough for me to start this analysis of Penn State leading up into this game without recognizing that loss to Colgate, which I feel like is going to be a stain and something that they have to do a great job of playing so well that we don't start talking about this with Colgate. And I feel like since that loss, they've done exactly that. They have been on a tear.
But it's also about Colgate, who's now 5-3, and they added a win over Loyola to their resume as well. So it's like, you know, it's a legacy of who Colgate was the last 2 years. But you're right. I feel exactly the same way in terms of like, it's not going to not be brought up this year. It will be a thing in May, for sure. But yeah, I mean, this game was crazy because, I think it was 9-1. Or 10-1 before Cornell made their third save. So Wyatt Nust got pulled. I didn't notice it until after Penn State's eighth goal, but the box score said it. He got pulled after their sixth goal. He had only made one save. And then freshman Matt Tully, who, you know, we ranked in the top 10 of the recruiting rankings and is, you know, one of my more favorite goalies in the recent past, largely because of what he does outside of the cage, in the clearing game and how athletic he is, came in and made one save and let in either three or four goals. And yeah, it's one of those things where, like, do you chuck the film and not analyze the game intently because the goalies just weren't able to make stops? Or was it a game where the goalies weren't able to make stops because the quality of the looks were so good because the defense wasn't up to snuff? And I think that for me, it was probably somewhere in the middle. You know, maybe they should have, you know, maybe they should have made five and let in seven as opposed to made two stops and let in 10. But that's kind of the difference between whether or not you're within striking distance from the standpoint of a comeback, because Cornell scored three goals in the last 2 minutes of the first half. And Penn State responded and then they scored the first two goals of the second half. So, you know, given that Penn State came back from down 9-2 against Yale the week prior, you know, I was watching this game thinking that Cornell had every opportunity to grab momentum and you know, pay back that on behalf of the Ivy League, pay that comeback back. And it just didn't happen. There was, you know, one of the elements, it was a little similar to the Hopkins game insofar as I think so. Angelo Petrakis and Mark Silos are effectively at this stage, I think you would call them kind of change of pace faceoff guys. Jack Escadden, who may be done for the season, don't have that confirmed yet, but was dominant in their season opening game and then hasn't played since. He's their number one. And one of the elements of that is, you know, those two guys each had two turnovers after faceoff wins. So there was this, you know, kind of component to even when you analyze the box score. I thought that Cornell, if there was one thing that was more frustrating, disappointing, indicative of why they lost than anything else, it was their ball handling in the middle of the field. It wasn't just limited to the faceoff guys. It was also in the clearing game. And, you know, it was some of their pulls, some of their short stick D-middies. They just weren't clean with their stick work in the middle of the field.
And, you know, even Coach Byrne made the comment earlier where he was talking about, yeah, you know, we got some saves and we won some faceoffs. And sometimes you kind of just have to chalk it up to a fluke. And I haven't watched enough of the game to just kind of credit it up to, well, Penn State's offense was absolutely ripping. They were placing their shots. They were doing this. But I don't think you can draw as big of a conclusion simply because sometimes we have to remember, you know, these are 18 to 22-year-old kids that can go out on the field and play like shit. I certainly know that I had my fair share of the game. I was just lucky to be in a position where that wouldn't impact the final score and being an 11-goal margin. Now, I probably contributed to a couple losses, but it doesn't show up on the score sheet like it does if you're in cage or if you're at the faceoff X. So, What this weekend really kind of did for me was get more excited about conference play as well. I was like, is this going to be another year where Cornell just kind of runs through the Ivies? Who's going to really, you know, come out and come out swinging? Harvard beats Michigan. Yale beats Denver. Jeez, I almost just forgot Denver. My goodness. So the conference play storylines are becoming more and more interesting. And
you couldn't ask for better timing because conference play is about to start all across the country,
baby. Let's go. These two are going to go hand in hand. So I'll kind of let you choose your own adventure, Terry. Go back to page 8 and select option A.
Well, this is like going back to the beginning of the season. Cause remember, this was basically how we would end the podcast. You give me 3 games and I got to pick which one we talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll do it. We'll crush it. And this absolutely goes in line with like the, do we give credit to team A or do we, you know, criticize team B? UVA played Towson, Maryland played Brown. UVA won 19-5. Towson got 15 up on Virginia, close game. Maryland won in overtime against Brown. And as we check in, as we do on a weekly basis on, you know, the Larkin Kemp mentals, let's get 2 wellness checks over for our boy Larkin Kemp. So Brown takes Maryland to the edge. Towson puts up a great fight against Virginia. Where do you start in these two games that kind of mirror each other?
Well, I actually start by adding Duke Loyola to it as well because wow, that game was 7-7 at halftime. So, you know, it was a similar type of separation in the second half that you saw in the Virginia game against Towson. But I also think that those 3 teams or those 3 games should be clumped together because they were all played in the Mid-Atlantic, you know, Baltimore, DC, and it was really raining hard. So not to like give excuses for why the games unfolded the way that they did, but also, you know, the Duke Penn game, very influenced by weather. So point being that, you know, are they mitigating circumstances or are they a reflection of what we're talking about, which is that, you know, regardless of the spread in the rankings, if you don't show up to play, no win is assured. I think it's kind of a function of all of it. I think that for me, it's the Maryland Brown game. And it's a combination of a couple things. One, what we've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast already, faceoffs and goal play. So Luke Weirman did not play in this game. Post-game comments suggested that it's possible he'll be back in time to take on Virginia. Virginia themselves, with Anthony Gobriel having missed their loss to Hopkins and also their midweek win over Robert Morris, they got Gobriel back against Towson. So a matchup to watch injury-wise as Maryland Virginia take on each other this coming Saturday. But with respect to what this if I'm isolating one thing from those kind of 6 sides of the ball, you know, Duke Loyola, Virginia Towson, Army Brown, or I'm sorry, Maryland Brown, I am I'm coming away very encouraged by what you can get from Brown's film offensively. And, you know, what does it mean going forward? Now they're 0-5. To your point about Larkin, he's isolated on the fact that it's a 6-8-5 game season, whatever the case may be.
Poor kid.
I would argue it's a 5-game season because you only need to win 3 regular season Ivy League games in order basically to be assured a spot in the Ivy League tournament, and then you need to win 2 of them in order to get into the NCAA tournament. But with that being said, yeah, very encouraging signs from the Brown offense. Mateo Corsi came alive. Aiden McLean is a known quantity. Jack Kelly was excellent. And they were resilient. They responded when Maryland responded. And so, yeah, a lot of positives to take away if you're Brown, for sure.
Got it. And then final, we'll just give you that classic 3-game spread, even though I just gave you a 2-game and you made it a 3-game spread. Let's double down and go to the 6-course meal. Vermont gets their first ever win over UMass. Notre Dame beats Ohio State in a game in which Ohio State scored 10 more goals than they did in 2015, with a final score of 13-10. And Penn is close versus Villanova. What do you got?
Yeah, I watched the Notre Dame-Ohio State game most closely, so I suppose I could give the best analysis of that one. But I actually think that the Vermont-UMass game is the most important result. UMass is, I had them, I think, 20th in my media poll vote last week. They had rebounded from, I don't even know how to describe it, because it wasn't like a middling showing against Army to open their season, but... you would have expected them, I guess, to win if Evan Plunkett didn't play well, and that was, his worst game of the season. So I don't know. I'm still struggling with exactly how to put that game into context. But ultimately, UMass, really good team. This is an important win for Vermont. Vermont is growing up, right? They graduated so much talent over the course of the last 2 years. They're really well coached. But they also, they're 2 years removed from losing Jared Bernhardt. So they've had some assistant turnover as well. They just need to replenish, right? And that's happening, I guess, would be the main point. So if memory serves, they get to open America East play with America's team, everybody's favorite 7-0 NJIT Highlanders, and that'll be a good test for both sides. So this time next week, we might have a clearer indication as to exactly how for real the Highlanders are, because Vermont has. I guess bounce back. That's probably too strong of a term, but they've started to right the ship, turn the corner a little bit relative to some of their early season struggles. In contrast to the last 3 years and the run that those Catamounts had.
Got it. And that does it for the slate of games. What a weekend it was! You really thought Notre Dame was going to lose as Terry Foy goes to celebrate St. Patrick's Day? Get out of here. And final point, I was going to start Anna Karenina, little book club point, but instead I started, I'm reading 3 nonfiction books right now that are all kind of closely aligned. I started Omnivore's Dilemma, I'm still reading Guns, Germs, and Steel, and I started War on the Run, which is about Rob Rogers, kind of essentially the first Special Forces guy who approached war differently. And it's essentially going to be about America and England's influence and how they essentially conquested the Wild West. So it's going to get into a lot of that. I'm very excited about it. And it's going to be good because I feel like sometimes you just reflect and you read about history and you're like, how could they not know? Like when I'm like, really? Like freaking Columbus thought he landed in India? What an idiot. And then you realize that these are just people on wooden ships going like, what the hell's that? So I'm very excited to bring in a little more personalization of history. Instead of just talking about World War II, shifting to a different era, I might be talking about the food chain insufferably, and I'm excited. Terry, anything on your slate?
I watched Oppenheimer on Friday night. Really enjoyed it. My succinct review is Cillian Murphy is an incredible actor, and the way in which his face was the arbiter of the moral quandary about whether or not to create a weapon of mass destruction was essential. I mean, really, just it was the entire movie. So, that's my review.
2.5 hours of him just looking morally compromised.
It really was. And it was. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. It exactly was.
Worth every second too. Seeing Dune 2 on Thursday, so we'll have movie review as well.
Nick, as always, a pleasure. Thank you for listening to the Tailgate Podcast. Hope that we didn't ruin your Monday morning commute. If you like what heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We'll be back next week with a tailgate that is sure to deliver given the amount of quality lacrosse action in store this weekend.
And no broadcast. I've been on like a 4-weekend broadcast stint, so I'll actually be able to get it, you know, watch the games in real time. It's going to be fantastic. Terry, I love you.
Love you more, Nick.
We're best friends.